So thank you all for coming out. Let me give you a brief introduction to who I am, mostly to set a little bit of context around how I'm approaching the notion of design patterns and sort of where my head has been at for the past 10, 11 years. So I've been a web guy since the beginnings of the web. I worked at NCSA, National Center of Supercomputing Applications, where Mosaic came out. Anybody use Mosaic? Browse the web, right? There you go. Yeah, old school. That spiraled into Netscape, and that spiraled into Internet Explorer and sort of kicked off the graphical web. From then, I did a bunch of teaching, consulting, spent 2 years at eBay, and now working as a principal designer at Yahoo in the social media team. So my background is very web-focused, and that's my context. So when I say things about web about design patterns, it's very much coming from a web background. And also, I mean, this 10 years of designing web applications and working in the web space has given me a lot of access to situations where I pick up on patterns. Volume, can you hear me now? Better? All right, I'll just have to lean in real close. Fireside chat. So why talk about design patterns? Well, if anybody catch the Unstuck panel this morning at 10? So one of the themes that came up when we were talking was around communication and the ability to sort of have a continuous dialogue between design teams, development teams, clients, stakeholders, what have you, everybody that's involved in building web applications. There's a lot of people because these things get more and more complex as time goes on. So design patterns, in a nutshell, give you what I kind of like to call a shared language. There's a story that I think Robin Williams tells in the Non-Designer's Design book, which I'm getting this quote from Bill Scott, where, you know, she went to her parents' house and found a tree in the backyard. And before she had a name for it, didn't know what to call it. But once you had a name, then you start seeing that tree in lots of places. And you go back home, you're like, wow, this tree's over here, this tree's over here. You know, it's a Joshua tree or what have you. So giving things a name is a really powerful way to start talking about it, building shared goals around it, etc. So when I talk about using patterns as a shared vocabulary, I'm talking about a means to communicate things between designers, clients, developers, etc. The other thing that's kind of interesting to me about design patterns is design patterns, and this come from this notion of pattern recognition. As our world gets in, can kind of continually more global, more networked, faster change, there's more and more data, more and more services, more and more connections happening left and right, and it's no longer really enough to parse information, right? You sort of have to begin to parse meta information, aka information about information. So you see all these sort of aggregator services, things which try and bubble up data about data. And a pattern is essentially data about data. You're observing lots of different things and you're building on those similarities and identifying, oh, this is this type of thing. So the notion of pattern recognition is becoming more and more important in today's networked information firehose age. Henry Jenkins, anybody catch his talk today, the interview? Yeah. As Dana says, fantastic. So he mentioned a book by Steven Johnson where he talks about everything bad is good for you, how this increasing complexity of media is teaching kids more complex concepts than the schools are. Schools are sort of dumbing down, media is smartening up. And he talks to a different kind of intelligence test outside of your standard intelligence tests and pulls out the specific example called these Raven progressive matrices, which are essentially pattern recognition tests. They give you visual information and you're supposed to kind of grok what's happening and determine what that pattern is. And it's kind of a way of looking at the world. And this kind of comes almost innately to people who have been trained in design. It's one of the things we look for is visual relationships between things. And we manipulate visual relationships via weight, via contrast to tell a story. So designers, I think, are in a unique position to sort of recognize patterns, not that anybody else can't or anything like that. And pattern recognition as a discipline is sort of growing in importance in, as our world gets more complex. So kind of a reason that I'm interested in it. So this talk, enough of the high-level stuff, I guess. We get in and get a little bit practical here. This talk came about from a number of online conversations that I kicked off with a few folks responsible for some of the more prominent design pattern libraries out there. And I'll get to what do I mean by a design pattern and what's in it in a second. But first, let me sort of introduce the folks that contribute a lot to my thinking around this topic. We have, actually, I'll dive into it in a second, but we, between these five folks, we had a couple of conversations. In May 2006 online, we talked about what do we mean by design patterns? What are they? Why are they relevant? Then in October, we really talked about how do you communicate them and who do you communicate them to and why? So one of these guys was Bill Scott. who was one of the brains behind taking the Yahoo Design Pattern Library. Has anybody seen the Yahoo Design Pattern Library? It's part of the Yahoo User Interface Toolkit, which it just entered its second year and had a very big party over on the Yahoo campus, which was fun. But a lot of components out there that you can use from a developer standpoint, but also a lot of design patterns associated with those components. So this used to be an internal system for sharing best practices between designers at Yahoo. Bill and a few others sort of got together and actually made it open source and are actually open. I don't think it's necessarily open source applies, but there's a Creative Commons license around it. It's very liberal. Anybody can sort of take these things and move forward. And Christian Krumlich, who's hanging out in the second row, you guys can heckle him later, provided he doesn't heckle me, is actually driving the Yahoo Design Pattern Library forward now and just had a recent release. So Bill Scott was actually supposed to be on this panel with me today. He had to go to Bangalore. So I'm actually going to channel him through the medium of PowerPoint as we move forward. And those of you that think PowerPoint is evil, we're about to find out because we're going to try and channel through it. So that's Bill. And, you know, these URLs that I'm pointing to are pattern libraries that you guys can index or access and grab content from and kind of learn from at any point in time. Jennifer Tidwell had a pattern library online and recently translated it into a very popular book called Designing Interfaces for O'Reilly. A lot of people that I've spoken to say this is the book they keep taking off their shelves when they're designing interactive applications because it does such a nice job of pulling these patterns together. And she recently redesigned her site around this book and had a baby. Martijn van Wiele was one of the first publicly accessible pattern libraries online that I'm aware of. There's a few others out there, but his is pretty robust, and it's really organized around sites, widgets, experiences, etc. And me and James Raffel sort of got into this. I spent 2 years at eBay working on platform initiatives from a design perspective across all the different buying experiences that eBay has. And one of the things that we did was try and pull together a library of best practices within eBay for, you know, the 100-plus designers, 30 different countries, etc., across the corporation. So we sort of had a shared resource. And I'll talk a little later about the history of how we actually got to a design pattern library anyhow. But so I was the original kind of architect on it, and James has taken it and grown it further. So all these folks have long lists of design patterns, right? But what are we talking about really when I say design patterns? Well, design patterns in a nutshell are solutions to problems in context. I think that's a really key point here. They're so in context, right? So that means they've worked successfully in some sort of situation that's been documented and it's been shared with people. That creates a pattern. So the classic design answer to what is the right answer is it depends, right? It always depends on the circumstances of the situation, what the appropriate situation is. So a design pattern takes that into account when it documents the solution. It says, in this particular situation, this solution worked well. It's a very key component. You can sort of think of patterns as Martijn calls it schemas. Are you familiar with the notion of a schema from psychology, kind of, right? So when a person recognizes a set of stimuli and they kind of assess, okay, this is a situation, they have a built-in process for handling that situation. So you see all these different variables and you say, okay, that is a X and I solve an X via using a Y. It's important to distinguish patterns from principles. Design principles are really foundational concepts that help guide and shape us. It's kind of like a moral compass, if you will, for design. Like, you know, do good, make things accessible, etc. Patterns, on the other hand, are specific enough to be practical, but they're general enough to be used in lots of different situations. Whereas guidelines, on the other hand, are very much focused on being very, very specific. Principles are a little too general. Patterns are somewhere in between in that nice fuzzy middle ground that we all like because it's warm and fuzzy. And I also use this notion of design vocabulary. Again, when you start recognizing things out in the wild, you're like, oh, that is a blank. Oh, this is a, etc. Having a name around design solution gives people a shared vocabulary. It can be a personal vocabulary. It can be a vocabulary shared between a design team or one that sort of includes everybody out there dealing with interactive applications. So how about some examples of patterns? And here's where I'm channeling Bill through PowerPoint. With his work of cataloging and naming a lot of rich interaction patterns. As you can see, this is a full list. There's more than this. But you can sort of note the proliferation of different actions in here, right? Configuring stuff, editing things, providing invitations, having transitions, allowing people to reorder, edit, drag and drop, etc. And so given that the best way to sort of illustrate a pattern is actually look at some. Some patterns out there are pretty broad. And this is animating, great. So this is, for example, drag and drop applied to the overall functionality of a page. Here, we're using this drag and drop pattern for customization of content, right? So this isn't just a page, it's a content experience. And this entire example here, My Yahoo, is built around the this content experience of being able to customize stuff. And you'll note there's a number of states with this pattern. It has kind of a transparent layer. It has an in motion. It has an indicator, which tells you, let's see if I can get it to play again. There we go. It has an indicator that shows you where, what actions are possible. It has timing associated with it. And all those things sort of get documented. How long does it wait before it moves the different thing? When you drop it, what's the action? What's the feedback being presented to you? All these things are sort of caught up within the design pattern. You can look at some, a little bit smaller scale stuff that doesn't apply to an entire experience there, like the drag and drop of a content module. Here at the top, we've got autocomplete, which is really useful for helping bound inputs, so help people avoid errors. So in situations where you can sort of message what the options are, like within an email client. We have an indication of progress with feedback. There's an inline feedback pattern in the middle that provides feedback indication. The one below it, this hover detail, gives you previews of things. You see Netflix using this an awful lot, Yahoo adopting this in a lot of places. It's kind of giving you a little bit of a lightweight preview of content before you have to commit to a full page download. And we can get even more widgety. So here, rating, voting, inline editing. There's a whole suite of things that this covers, right? The entire page experience versus individual sort of actions all the way down to the widget level. And the list of patterns sort of goes on and on and on and on and on. And I could, in fact, go on and on about showing you guys different patterns and talking about them. But since we're on a 20-minute leash, I encourage you to go check out Bill's site, the Yahoo Pattern Library, Jennifer's book, Martine's site, etc. All these things are great resources. So I won't drone on and on about what all the different patterns are that are out there. But I'll talk about some interesting implications of them. So because design patterns are solutions to problems, the problems that they are solutions to can be big problems or small problems, right? So there's sort of a scope of design patterns. Some of the things apply at a very high level, like frameworks. Framework is a way to sort of organize full interaction models, flows, even application archetypes, right? This is a reporting application. This is a messaging application. This is a social application, or have you. That's a pretty broad one, but they can go up to a pretty high level. And then down at the bottom of this scope is actually the components, sort of the elements that you use within these frameworks, the widgets, if you will. And there's a whole range of things in between. Now, when we did design patterns at eBay, this is sort of what we settled on after going through a whole bunch of different semantic arguments about what is it not. And it seemed to work really well to sort of bound it at the top and bound it at the bottom and then say, you know, I love this fuzzy middle stuff because that's just kind of the way the world really works. Categorization is never as precise as you want it to be. But others have tried something more full range. So SAP, if you look at their pattern concept, they've got floor plans, applications, elements. They even have those mapped to task hierarchies of workflow, composite task, task, action, etc. And when we put our things together, we took a look at this and we just sort of thought it was a little too much. We wanted to be a lot more nimble when people are documenting things. We didn't want them to have to consider, oh, is this a floor plan for an application? Or am I really dealing with a pattern element of a UI control? Yeah. Don't even think about it. Either you're doing something really kind of big, it's solving a big problem, or you're doing something kind of smaller and you're solving a smaller problem. And so what that amounts to, like the Yahoo pattern library, there's the grid system, which is basically a framework. It's a series of patterns for organizing information on screens. You can combine these in lots of different ways. You can access it, see how they're going. And then sort of at the other opposite end of the spectrum is breadcrumbs, right? So breadcrumb kind of gives you a path of where you are within an application, lets you navigate back and forth, but it could fit it within those frameworks as needed. The basic message why I point to these different ways of structuring frameworks is to put out there that you don't need to overthink how they're working. The only thing to consider is these are solutions in context, and sometimes that context is pretty wide, sometimes that context is pretty narrow. So we've seen some libraries, and we've seen what's inside of them, which is patterns, of course. And I've been talking a lot about, you know, these things are documentation of best practices. But how are these things getting documented? What are we actually cataloging in these libraries? So when we take a look at what's actually in a design pattern, I've just sort of run a survey of a lot of different pattern libraries out there and the things that we've done. Basically, there's a name for it, which, again, is really important for sharing stuff. There's the problem. So, you know, what are we trying to solve here? What are the user needs? Then there's basically an example to set the context. There's the ability to document when you should be using this. What are the constraints? There's potentially some rationale why it works like this, how to apply it. And on the Yahoo pattern library, we have We have accessibility considerations for patterns. Sometimes we have code samples, etc. The key goal here is just to really communicate these things in a few clear, concise sections. So you can hear, see here the rating widget, or the rating pattern on the Yahoo pattern library. And you see it's not too big, just a few key questions. And again, the key things in here, really, you know, what's the situation? What's the problem? What's the user need? What are some constraints that this addresses? This helps frame the context. And then what's the answer? And give a few examples. Okay, so now we know what patterns are, where they're found, and how they're documented. But really, where how they're used is where the rubber hits the road. And I've kind of pulled up two general trends for design patterns out there. One is this sort of notion of a style guide replacement, especially for large web properties. Style guides, and I'll point to why in a second, really become unmanageable really quickly. Design patterns tend to be a little bit more flexible. And then there's also the nice stuff. So just sharing of best practices, either with the web community at large, with designers sharing with developers, designers sharing between designers, or designers just documenting things for themselves. So let's take a look at what I mean by style guide replacements. This is the way it was at eBay a few years ago. We had what was known as the Big Silver Book. And this was a giant book that had a full-baked style guide in it. And basically, the day it came out was the day it became obsolete. As James Raphael likes to say, within 6 months, it was actually dangerous. Because literally, the day we got this back from the printers, we had already changed stuff, right? The eBay is the 30th largest economy in the world. It's represented in over 30 countries. It has 160 million users. In the U.S. alone, there's 700,000 people using it for their house, their permanent income, their full-time job. So the thing is constantly in flux, right? You can't write a documentation and be like, this is where it stands, because the problem's never solved. Any problem that involves people is a problem whose parameters are always changing over time, which I got from Bruce Sterling. Hopefully he's not here to correct me. Okay. So you can't say, okay, this is done. Things are constantly in flux. And so what was wrong with this style guide, which, you know, a lot of folks still kind of ascribe to style guide mythology? Well, there's obvious things that are wrong with it. It's static, right? It's dead because it's printed. It's hard to use because it's pretty big and unyieldy, what have you. But there's less obvious things that are wrong on it. The things that were in it were either principles, very high-level stuff, like provide a well-lit path. Don't confuse the user. What do you do with that, right? It's not very actionable. And then there was very, very specific things, like 5 pixels of padding have to be on the around the button. Like, okay, well, that's great, but it doesn't really help me solve problems. So there was too general, too specific, but not a lot of things that were just right. And with in between principles and guidelines, that's where the action is, right? The action in a dynamic environment like eBay, where there's, you know, 160 million users, 30th largest economy in the world, the action is where the problems are being solved. The action isn't whether it's 5 pixels or 6 pixels. You know, and a lot of people here will say, well, eBay is terribly designed. Yet somehow it's basically it has democratized commerce, right? So clearly something is going right in that area. And it's really how people's problems are being solved in there. So now, and it's been, you know, a little while since I've been over there, but when I left, we had a pattern library. A lot of the components that we discussed were sort of being documented. What's the problem? When should you use this solution? What examples were there? Who to contact around it? And you can see here some high-level framework at the top, components on the bottom. We have things like covering the use of bold in China. How do you solve that problem? Turns out, and you know, when you render fonts the same way you use your CSS in the US, it doesn't necessarily work very well for Asian characters, especially the ones used on our China site. And then like frameworks, how do all these things fit together contextually across the site? Now, here's the Oracle design pattern for a footer. So this has visual specs, code recommendations, the same type of pattern information we've been looking for, etc. And I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know how this actually runs at Oracle, but for me, this doesn't have enough slack within it to make it effective as what it's trying to do. It sort of kills the notion of that beautiful fuzzy middle that makes design patterns work, because it gets all the way down to too specific. It basically becomes an online, even though they call this a pattern library, I would definitely say this is getting a lot more to a pretty specific style guide. So then the question you might be asking, okay, this is great. This might work for big design teams at eBay and Yahoo and maybe the World Wide Web in general, but does it really work for clients? Can, you know, web design agencies start giving out, you know, pattern documentation instead of style guides? Personally, I think it's possible. I haven't necessarily seen it done, very often, but the things that make it a bit compelling is it focuses on solutions as opposed to rules, right? So very often I did consulting for 10 years. Very often you drop off this beautiful design, you check back a week later and something's gone horribly wrong, right? These things sort of take on a life of their own. And giving people a way to solve problems that will come up later is actually better than setting a bunch of rules for what they have to do right now. So I think there's some potential in that space. And the other thing I kind of like about it is it really helps people do the right thing. This is that whole notion of it being practical enough to actually give you an answer, but high level enough to point you to the right way of doing things. And style guides, in my mind, really focused on the what. Here's what it is, you know, 15 pixels, etc. Whereas design patterns give you a little bit more of the why and the how and some more of that thinking. And just one last point. When I was doing consulting, when I was doing consulting, there was a lot of common things that I would sort of reuse within style guides. And I think within patterns, you can kind of apply the same thing and sort of reuse those as well. So I'm going to whiz through this next section because I'm on 5 minutes. So what about sharing best practices with developers, with designers? Right now, there's lots of different ways to browse the patterns that are online. Martijn's site has it really based on type, page, navigation, search. The Yahoo pattern library breaks it down into user needs or application needs. Jennifer's site really builds it around tasks, navigation, input, presentation. But a compelling way to start think about it is Bill Scott did this mind map sort of exercise where he broke it down into user-centered goals and design constraints. So you can sort of say, what does the user really want to do? That's what we're talking about as the problem. The problem is, what are the user needs? And then the use when, the context, is actually the design constraints. So for example here, you can see, I can't actually see it. Needs to navigate, or on the designer side, needs to group related items, or needs to organize a page or screen. You can kind of dig down into here and come up with a solution. And by the way, you can make a big old map tree. So let me show this with an example rather than hanging out on this tree for too long, because that's pretty crazy stuff. So common problem that everybody hits when designing forms, top right or left aligned form labels. Who votes top? All right. Who votes left? All right. Who votes right? All right. And the rest of you don't design forms. Okay. Which I don't believe for a second. But so this is a common scenario, right? Maybe this is a checkout form. Maybe this is a registration form. Maybe it's an upload form. Forms broker commerce. They broker community registration. They broker data generation. So they're pretty darn important. So let's look at top-aligned labels, right? With top-aligned labels, when the data being collected is very familiar, top-aligned labels make it very fast to get through the page. They require more vertical space, but they have a lot of flexibility for localization. So because the things are vertical, you can stretch it, change languages. French gets 200% longer. Chinese gets 200% shorter. These things flex well. So here's an example of top-aligned labels. Right-aligned labels have a pretty clear association between the label and the field. They require less physical space, but they make it challenging to actually scan the labels on the left. But yet people complete these pretty quickly as well. So here's right-aligned labels. Left-aligned labels are actually pretty good when data is unfamiliar because they slow people down and they enable you to scan all the items. So there's a little less of an association between the label and the field. They still take a little vertical space, but they might impair the ability to sort of read through the labels. And also, if you stretch those labels via localization or lots of different line lengths, the layout can get funky. And so here's an example of left-aligned labels for a advanced settings thing that you don't want people messing with too much and going through too quickly. And then there's a whole bunch of eye tracking data that sort of maps this to this. You can see on the right aligned label thing down here, people use a single saccade to sort of parse label and input with the top aligned, which is why they're able to get through it so quickly. And you can see at the top one where it's left aligned, they can make the associations between label and field, but it takes a while. So this leads to kind of an overall best practice. If your goal is to reduce completion times and you're dealing with familiar data, you probably want to use top aligned. If vertical screen space is a constraint, you might want to go right aligned. If you're dealing with unfamiliar or advanced data entry and you want to slow people down, have them think about what they're entering and consider the inputs, you might want to go left aligned. So if we map that to the structure we just put forward for design patterns, the user wants to either register, make a purchase, they want to give us info, and they want to get done fast. The designer wants them in and out because that means money or registration or data. They want to get that data from people, and they want to use a minimum of vertical real estate. So take those user needs and those design constraints, and in this particular case, considering right-aligned labels is a good way to go. I'll wrap up in the last 10 seconds here. Some opportunities for moving forward with design patterns is opening them up as web services using either JSON, API, XML, what have you, integrating design patterns in the toolkits. I've been talking with the folks over at Dojo, having design patterns within there, or actually integrating all these design pattern libraries that are out there into a single resource, either enabled via web services or toolkits or what have you. And thank you very much. Sorry, I went through that last part very, very quickly. Do we have time for questions, or do I got to cut out of here? Okay, I'll take a few questions. Yeah.
Sorry, I found that last bit to be probably the most interesting of the whole.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is that stuff with the best practices you kind of think we can find in the app?
Yeah. The problem. Yeah. So the question was, he finds the best practices stuff to be the most interesting. And, can we find that stuff in the Yahoo Design Pattern Library? Yeah, but it's not organized in that way right now. Right. So that's what I was kind of pointing to with that mind mapping exercise. That would be great if you could sort of say, here's my user needs. Here's my design constraints and what pops out. It's just these things aren't organized that way. You have to dig through and find that information. Is that with the code? Yeah, I don't know the code stuff. This is a technical question around the code stuff and the classes. So Christian can cover that. I'm going to put him on the spot. All right, actually, further questions, you guys can come up here. So I'll be up here for a little bit.
Cool.
Thank you.